The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew Mariani today, taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. We're talking a little bit about the Supreme Court in this hour, a couple of the momentous decisions, one of which came down today, and that was West Virginia versus EPA. And this had to do with how the EPA's enabling statutes are structured and whether or not they could expand the Clean Air Act into areas of carbon emissions. And the Supreme Court ruling today that Congress did not grant them that authority, that was a major question. And the major question cannot be addressed through regulatory expansion without congressional authorization. This is getting a lot of reaction today, although maybe not as much reaction as we saw in Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health on Friday, but still quite a bit of reaction. Here to discuss that with us is Frank Garrison. He's an attorney with the Pacific Legal Foundation. He specializes in environmental law and how it interacts with private property rights. He also works on upholding the Constitution's separation of powers. And before working at PLF, he worked at the Cato Institute's Center for Constitutional Studies, was a staff attorney with the National Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation, and you can find Pacific Legal at pacificlegal.org. Frank, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ed. Thanks for having me.
So, Frank, I have to admit something before you and everyone else and the Lord. I'm a Supreme Court nerd. The last month of the term, I'm online. I'm hitting the F5 refresh button on the Supreme Court page. I'm trying to find out, you know, when those decisions are going to drop, and I even know what the R number is, and that really makes you a nerd in Supreme Court circles. But you know, I'm not a lawyer, and so it's very interesting to go through these as a layperson. You are a lawyer, and I first off, I want you to give us what your impressions were in the majority opinion here, which is a 6-3 majority opinion in West Virginia v. EPA, about limiting the EPA in the manner that Chief Justice John Roberts did.
Yeah, so the Chief Justice, he lays out the history of he goes through the statute pretty well. I mean, Justice Roberts has a really, really good way of making complex statutes like the Clean Air Act and put them in simple terms. So he does a really good job of that, and he lays the background. But then he talks about, he applies the major questions doctrine. He says that, EPA started using this little used provision of the Clean Air Act. They hadn't used it. They'd only used it a couple times in the previous, 30 years or so. And, he applies the major questions doctrine and says, EPA is, they're essentially trying to, find what you would term an elephant in the mouse hole.
Right.
So the Chief Justice goes through that. He goes through the history of cases like Brown and Williamson, where the FDA tried to regulate tobacco through a broad provision. He even cited the COVID cases from earlier this year.
The eviction moratorium that the CDC
Yeah, the eviction moratorium and yep. The vaccine mandate case. I believe he cited that as well. So.
Oh, I think you're right. Yes.
Yeah. And, he makes the point that, because EPA hasn't used this provision before and it's trying to expand its authority, that, we don't allow agencies to do that. We don't allow them. One of his quotes is to add pages to an open book. They don't have a blank check through congressional statutes to just enact, whatever regulations they want.
Well, right. I mean, in part of this, I mean, the CDC case, I thought, was very, very predictive of what this outcome was going to be, because the CDC case was similarly situated. You had an executive branch agency which operates under a enabling statute passed by Congress, where it can do certain things by a regulation rather than having Congress pass statutes, right? And this is part of the whole agency law realm of federal governance, it's been, you know, a century or more that it's really been used. It's really accelerated maybe over the last 50 years or so. But basically, these agencies like the EPA and the CDC, they sort of exist in a partnership between Congress and the executive branch, and maybe even a little bit in the judiciary, depending on which agency we're talking about, in which all of these branches sort of, I don't want to say concede their authority, but sort of lend their authority so that these agencies can both create regulation, then enforce regulation, and then make determinations as to whether or not that regulation's been followed properly and issue fines. So that's, this is basically almost like a self-perpetuating form of governance rather than self-governance. And in recognition of that, and this is something that Roberts leans on heavily in today's, I think maybe Neil Gorsuch actually leans more heavily on this in his concurrence than even Roberts does in the main opinion. In order to keep that under control, Congress has to set strict boundaries and the judiciary has to make sure that they abide by these. And in the CDC case, there was no authority granted to the CDC to be involved at all in terms of, you know, rental and housing policy. And so the court yanked back pretty hard on that and said, no, you know, you've overstepped your authority. This is very much the same thing here, which is that the Clean Air Act is really about particulate emissions and dealing with particulate emissions. And there was no broad grant to do anything beyond that. That's pretty much, I mean, and it's more technical than that. So you have to really delve into the details, but conceptually and broadly, that is basically what we're talking about here, right?
No, that's exactly right. So, you know, Justice Roberts doesn't do it quite as explicitly as Justice Gorsuch does in his concurrence, but they talk about how, you know, these are clear statement rules. The major questions doctrine is a clear statement rule. And Justice Gorsuch goes through the history of clear statement rules and, you know, says that since the beginning of our republic, the court has been applying clear statement rules to police the boundaries between, you know, police the boundaries between Congress and, you know, agencies or whenever Congress is stepping over its constitutional bounds. So, you know, Justice Gorsuch talks about how the major questions doctrine is one of those clear statement rules that's grounded in the separation of powers. So, you know, whenever an agency is seeking to regulate something really big, you know, the court needs to know that, you know, Congress explicitly allowed that. Otherwise, you know, agencies are free to just write rules, you know, on they're basically allowed to change the law.
Right.
So, you know, and Justice Gorsuch goes through, you know, quite a few factors when the major questions doctrine applies. You know, if what the agency is trying to do is politically significant, I don't think anybody thinks that climate change isn't something that's politically significant nowadays.
Right.
You know, and he talks about if it's going to be economically transformative. And, you know, as the Chief Justice and Justice Gorsuch point out, you know, the transition that the EPA was trying to force power plants into was going to cost a lot of money. You know, whether or not you think that's a good idea, it was going to be very costly.
Right.
You know, and he also talks about federalism, Justice Gorsuch does. You know, and states traditionally regulated the energy sector. And so you have to have a respect for that.
Right. And I remember during the Obama administration, when the Clean Air Act was being discussed in terms of carbon emissions, that there was a not just carbon emissions, also particulate emissions. They were trying to use it to shut down coal, coal-fired power plants. And they were saying that, well, you can use that because the emissions from coal plants could cross, you know, state boundaries. And so therefore it's interstate commerce. And I'm not sure whether the court at that time prohibited that. I do seem to recall that it didn't really fly. Maybe you have better a better sense of that than I do. But I mean, this is, it's not the first time that the Clean Air Act has been used in that matter. For that matter, it's not the, you know, the Clean Water Act has been used for a number of times for expansions of EPA's authority, not through Congress, but through the EPA and through the executive branch. So this is, the EPA is sort of one of those nexus agencies, which really has to be kept in careful check, because otherwise that type of authority really could reach literally everywhere and touch everybody's private property.
No, that's exactly right. So most of the environmental statutes, like the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act, are they're issued under Congress's commerce power. And,
right.
You know, for a really long time, the Supreme Court has, you know, since the 1930s has basically, 1930s and 1940s has, you know, been pretty lenient on policing the enumerated powers as far as the Commerce Clause. And so, you know, when the federal government has that expansive power and then they pass these, you know, statutes with vague wording or ambiguous terms, and, you know, EPA seizes on that, and then they go and they regulate wide swaths of people's private property, you know, and entire industries like the energy sector. So, and, you know, a lot of times they're not really cabined. So it's really important for the Supreme Court to step in and make sure that, you know, they're abiding by the statutes Congress wrote and not going beyond what Congress wrote, and making sure that they have clear authority to do what they're doing.
We are speaking with Frank Garrison, attorney with the Pacific Legal Foundation, pacificlegal.org. We're taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149, discussing West Virginia, the EPA, which is a very interesting case. And there's a lot of media coverage of this, Frank, that says, well, the Supreme Court has just shut down the ability to deal with climate change. The Supreme Court has robbed the EPA of its authority to deal with climate change. And that's, first off, the EPA didn't have this specific authority. That's what this decision says. But it doesn't preclude Congress from granting it, right? I mean, this is all this is basically saying is, if you want this type, if Congress wants to assign the EPA this type of authority in this specific broad field, which this is, then it needs to do so explicitly through statute. And there's nothing preventing Congress from doing that, except Congress itself.
Oh, absolutely not. So, I mean, you know, Congress could write a law tomorrow and, you know, possibly enact the Clean Power Plan. You know, it's Justice Gorsuch points out, I mean, he answers this question. I mean, legislation at the federal level is meant to be difficult. I mean, that's a feature of our Constitution. It's not a bug.
Right.
Because it produces better policy when everybody comes together and they compromise and they determine what's best for the American people, you know, based on that compromise, not on political factions that, you know, might be able to capture agencies. So they're in a better position than agencies to actually produce good policy. You know, we don't want the EPA to be able to change the law based on, you know, shifting political whims that haven't gained a broad consensus by the American people.
Right. And to the point that, especially that Gorsuch makes, but Roberts makes it as well, is that the EPA isn't the lawmaking authority. Constitutionally speaking, that is the legislature. And the legislature can, through agency law, can certainly devolve some of the more minor questions. If we're going to use major questions as a doctrine, which it is, we can just call them minor questions. So you can regulate on the minor questions. We're going to see this at the ATF too, for instance, you know, once they install, if and when they install the, you know, the ATF director, Steve Dettelbach is the nominee, and they're still waiting to schedule a confirmation. But when he gets there, he could promulgate regulation that has to do with some of the more minor, you could say detailed regulatory issues that the ATF will have to deal with. And that's the proper part of the job. The EPA has similar scope to do that. But if you're going to add a complete new category of this, then it really needs to go through the branch where the people's elected representatives are the ones who actually promulgate that policy. And it's the people's elected representatives that are directly accountable for whatever is produced in the legislature. That's true at the state level. It's true at the federal level as well.
No, that's exactly right. And, you know, Justice Gorsuch lays this out well. He talks about how administrative agencies might be able, in the executive branch in general, might be able to fill in details of statutes. But the big policy questions, and there's no doubt that climate change is a big policy question, and what to do about it. And he makes the point, he's not tipping the scales in any one policy direction. He's just saying that when these big policy questions come about, it has to be Congress and the people's elected representatives that make the call. And then administrative agencies can fill in details. So, as long as they're not changing the law, then that's perfectly within the constitutional bounds.
And my guess is that this is going to probably impact the number of cases that are already percolating around because, well, let's ask that question. And again, we're speaking with Frank Garrison of Pacific Legal Foundation, pacificlegal.org. What is the reach of this decision? And what is the scope of this decision? I think that I've seen some commentary on this that Chief Justice John Roberts tried his best to keep it on the narrow side, but it does seem like a rather broad rebuke to the EPA and to the agencies in general that are seeking to expand their fiefdoms sort of thing, empire building, I guess is what I'm trying to is a phrase I'm trying to, it's sort of a rebuke to that. How much will this reach into other such cases? For instance, on the waters of the U.S. rule, which has been, a contentious debate for several years now.
No, I think it will have an effect on other cases. One big result that, I think may come from today's opinion, especially when you combine what Chief Justice Roberts said in his majority and what Justice Gorsuch said in his concurrence is, they're explicitly acknowledging the measure questions doctrine now. I think there was some speculation that they were just applying this, willy-nilly in different cases. And, it was kind of a rule of statutory construction. But I think between those two opinions today, they make it clear that there is a clear statement rule that they're going to apply when administrative agencies try and do big things and make big policy choices, and that runs up against changing the statute, and both make that point. So I do think that is going to have some precedential effect for when agencies go and they try and do really big things. I think they're going to look at West Virginia v. EPA and have second thoughts because, the court made it clear that they're going to apply clear statement principles when it's proper. And, Justice Gorsuch does a really good job of laying out certain factors when that clear statement rule, the major questions doctrine, applies. So, I think that'll give lower courts a lot of guidance, too, that they've needed for a long time to be able to apply the major questions doctrine in different contexts. So, I do think it will have some effect on different cases.
So let me ask you this. I mean, I know that you pursue environmental law cases at Pacific Legal Foundation. Again, pacificlegal.org. Do you have any cases that you think are going to be impacted by this decision, I would presume, based on what I know about Pacific Legal Foundation, do you have any cases that you think are going to be helped by this decision, I think is a better way of putting this?
Well, we litigate under the Clean Water Act and, the Endangered Species Act. And the agencies that administer those statutes are always trying to to do big things. So,
right.
I think it will tamper down what the agencies do in those situations where they go to make rules to change, the meaning of those statutes. And so, I think it'll affect our cases in the fact that, the agencies are going to be a little bit more reticent to issue rules that fundamentally try and change the law and how those statutes are interpreted.
And in the meantime, the impact of this is, and the impact of this is going to be significant because the EPA was trying to use that clean power plan to force coal producing electricity generators to shut down. It's the reason why West Virginia was bringing this lawsuit, or at least was the lead plaintiff in this lawsuit. I think there were others that joined it. That pretty much basically puts that whole process to a halt, right? Those operators are not going to be are not going to have their operations impacted, at least not from this. That is going to require some sort of congressional action to move forward on. But in the meantime, the clean power plan is pretty much dead, right?
No, that, I think that's right. The Biden administration had told the Supreme Court that they were going back to the drawing board and were going to be promulgating a new rule. They said it was going to be within a year or so, but I think they delayed that a week or two ago and said that it's going to be a little bit longer, maybe 2024, before they have a new rule out that would regulate these existing power plants. So they're going to have to go back to the drawing board. It doesn't mean the decision today doesn't mean that they're not going to be able to regulate. So
right.
The way the Clean Power Plan tried to regulate was through generation shifting. So it was trying to force these existing power plants to basically use different sources of energy, which would have shut a bunch of them down. But that doesn't mean that they can't go back and issue a new rulemaking to basically regulate these existing power plants through basically technology and scrubbers and what's called inside the fence line. So when they set these emission standards, they can basically look to what a power plant could do to their specific plant to, within reasonable, they have to take into account things like costs, but they can still set those emissions limitations based on stuff that the individual power plants can do at their facilities, like install scrubbers that will they'll make whatever they're emitting cleaner.
Right, they can do regulation based on rational and non-arbitrary emission standards for one thing, and they can require certain equipment to be in the line. But what they can't do is artificially cap the use of source material or artificially cap the production, which is what this clean power plan, was going to do. And I think it's Roberts that talks a little bit about that in the main opinion, which is, it's the arbitrariness of these caps, which have the effect of basically putting these companies out of business. And for something like that, you really need Congress to authorize it. The other things are less in the major question issue. And we've got maybe, 30 seconds or so. I'll let you wrap up.
No, I think West Virginia v. EPA, I think the opinion of Justice Roberts was really good, and Justice Gorsuch's concurrence was excellent as well. They are laying the groundwork and in enforcing our separation of powers. So, the clear statement principle that they announced today, that, it had been in some cases, hinted at in some cases before, but they made it clear today that, federal agencies need a clear statement from Congress before they try and issue transformative rules that are going to have major consequences for the economy and that involve, significant political questions. So,
right.
Today, Supreme Court went a long way to upholding the separation of powers.
Well, Frank Garrison of Pacific Legal Foundation, thank you so much for discussing West Virginia v. EPA. You can find it at pacificlegal.org, pacificlegal.org. They do a lot of great work there. We love talking with Pacific Legal's scholars and attorneys. When we come back, we're going to talk about another court decision from the past few days, the Bruin case, and what may be coming next on the Bruin case. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew Mariani. We'll be right back.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
If you don't live what you believe, you'll end up believing what you live. You're listening to The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
It's 31 minutes past the hour. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew today, taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. Another big case that came down in the last few days, the New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus Bruin. This was a very important case in terms of the ability to not just keep, but also bear arms outside of the home. This is about carry permits. And it was a dispute with the state of New York over what is called a May issue regime of permitting. 43 states have shall issue, which means that if you, as long as you don't have some sort of objective and standardized reason for not being granted a carry permit, if you're a law-abiding citizen otherwise, and you apply for one, the state is required to issue you one, as long as you've gone through the training, as long as you've gone through the qualification. New York, it was the burden of proof was on the applicant to prove that they needed a carry permit, which allowed a bureaucrat basically to arbitrarily decide whether or not they liked that reason or not. This is what the lawsuit was over. And the court very firmly said that that was a constitutional infringement, and that while permits were certainly constitutionally valid, the setup in New York State was unconstitutional. And we're going to talk a little bit about that. We're going to talk a little bit about whether or not that's the limit of Bruin, because there was some interesting information in the Supreme Court orders this morning as well. Joining us to discuss this is David Koppel. He's a research director for the Independence Institute in Denver, associate policy analyst with the Cato Institute in Washington. He's also an adjunct professor of constitutional law at Denver University's Sturm College of Law. He's the author of The Morality of Self-Defense and Military Action, the Judeo-Christian Tradition. You can find him online at davekoppel.org, that's K-O-P-E-L, and on Twitter at Dave Koppel. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So very interesting. This is a very interesting decision, and for more than one reason, right? This is an extension of Heller. It's an extension of McDonald. It is basically the logical extension of both of those, because once you have found that there is an individual right to both keep and to bear arms, it follows logically that the state should have to show a good reason why you are not allowed to do that. And yet you still had seven states that were operating under what's called the May issue regime. And now that you have the Bruin case, presumably all seven of those states are going to mend their ways, or do you expect them to do that?
I think that will vary, and it's going to be a state-by-state thing. So, for example, in New Jersey, the attorney general, who's, you know, very anti-gun, still seems to be straightforwardly following the law and said, okay, you know, in New Jersey, handgun carry permits are issued by the local police chiefs. What you local police chiefs should do is go ahead and issue permits the same way you always do, in the sense of, you know, fingerprinting and background checks and sure, all that kind of stuff. But you don't require people to have a special need, which New Jersey had previously done. So in New Jersey, until last week, you couldn't get a handgun permit unless you were under a very specific criminal threat. I mean, even if you were somebody who was clearly in danger of attack in general, you know, like a diamond merchant who transports his wares,
right,
or a doctor who makes house calls and carries narcotics, even those people couldn't get a carry permit in New Jersey. And so the attorney general said, no, that's all over. Do everything we always do on pistol carry permits, except the part about saying somebody has to have some unique need for self-defense. In other places like New Jersey, New York, and California, there's a lot of resistance, you know, just as there was a lot of resistance in some states after the Supreme Court outlawed school segregation in Brown versus Board of Education.
Sure.
I mean, it took years to finally get that enforced in some places.
decades, actually, in some cases,
yes.
Which is the reason why you had the busing policy that was put in place, because, I mean, again, there was all sorts of different – I don't think it's going to be quite that bad, but certainly there's going to be some resistance to this, because there's going to be popular resistance to this. The reason why you had laws in those states that were structured that way was because, at least at the time that they were passed, they were fairly popular. And what New Jersey's doing is basically, like you said, following the dictum of the Supreme Court here, because that's really the only difference. I've lived in shall issue states, and I now live in a constitutional carry state, but one that still has a permit process. And in both cases, the permit process is just as you described. You get fingerprinted, you go through background training, you have to get certified by an instructor. You have to go to a range and demonstrate some level of competence at handling the firearm, and then you get issued a permit, and it's for a time-limited amount of, it's for a time-limited period, and at the end of that time limit, you got to go back and requalify all over again. And that's constitutional. I mean, that part is constitutional, and there's nothing in Bruin that says that states can't do any of that. It just says that you can't require some sort of I use the term bureaucratic.
You don't have to prove you're special.
You don't have to prove
that
you're special.
The difference is,
right, yes.
Yeah, it's the fact that you're just a normal, law-abiding American citizen is a good enough reason to want a permit.
Right, and to carry a firearm. And again, you got about 25 states now that have so-called constitutional carry where they don't require permits at all. And Vermont that's been the case in Vermont for, I think, decades. I'm not sure that Vermont
since 1903.
Ever had permits. Yeah. And so, now 25 states or so have that. And even in those states, there's also still usually a permitting regime. And the permit will grant you, a little extra, a little extra entree into what might be termed sensitive areas. And this was another issue in Bruin that came up, which was the sensitive areas question. Because even in shall issue states, there are limits to where you can actually carry that even if you do have a permit, right? I mean, you can't carry
right.
into courtrooms, for instance. And I'm just going to draw off of Minnesota. I moved away from Minnesota a year ago, but I'm most familiar with that. You know, there's if you're going into a private, a privately owned public place where the owner doesn't want people carrying, they put up a sign that says you are not allowed to carry in here, and you either have to leave, you have to leave your firearm behind, or you can get a $25 fine for trespassing under those circumstances if you're caught and you refuse to leave. So there are limits to this, and the Supreme Court talked about this, and apparently at one point New York tried to define a sensitive place as anywhere in public where people congregate and law enforcement might be present, which is so ambiguous as to be a meaningless standard. It essentially means that you can't do it anywhere.
That's right. And the Justice Thomas, in his majority opinion, explained that we should do the sensitive places aspect of this, and that the sensitive places were part of the Heller decision too, where they said
right.
We don't mean to call into question long-standing laws prohibiting the carrying of guns in sensitive places such as schools and government buildings. And Justice Thomas elaborated on that, and he said, in general, the way you decide Second Amendment cases is if you decide if a particular gun control is consistent with American history and tradition. And if it is, fine, and if it's not, then it's unconstitutional. Judges don't get into the, being like a super legislature where they weigh the policy pros and cons. It's just
right.
It's now just a history and tradition test. So he said an example of that is how you do sensitive places. So there's what Heller said, and then he said, citing an article I wrote, that in the 19th century there were some places that states that had bans on carrying guns in courthouses or polling places. And he said you can, if you want to ban guns in other places, you can see if you can draw analogies to those 19th century limits. But he also went to say, but you can't, like, go crazy on it, you know, and specifically said you can't call the entire island of Manhattan a sensitive place. So there will be lots of litigation on the contours of that as time goes on. And obviously one of the ways the anti-civil rights jurisdictions are going to try to de facto nullify the Bruin decision is by defining every building they can think of as a sensitive place, plus parks and lots of other stuff. So there'll be lots of litigation on that in the coming years.
Yeah, there'll be some fine-tuning along those lines, I am sure. We're speaking with David Koppel, Research Director of the Independence Institute in Denver, an Associate Policy Analyst with the Cato Institute, and Adjunct Professor of Constitutional Law at Denver University's Sturm College of Law, taking your calls at 888-914-9149. I want to talk about the interesting piece in the majority opinion written by Clarence Thomas, where he talks about the two-step review being unnecessary and the one-step review being all that's necessary. Now you started talking about that just a moment ago, and the reason why I'm going to ask that is because we're going to talk a little bit here. We're going to take a break, and when we come back after the break, I want to talk about what that might mean in the next term, because I think there's some really interesting signals that were sent this morning. But tell us a little bit, first off, about the implications of one step versus the two step.
Okay, so we had the Heller decision, and that was very much a decision that was based on, I mean, first of all, the text of the Second Amendment. That's in constitutional law, the text should always be the most important thing. Then as that text is illuminated by subsequent history and tradition. And that's what Heller was based on. The court didn't get into Justice Breyer's dissent wanted to talk all about the pro-con social science on handguns and self-defense and everything else, and the Justice Scalia's majority said, no, we don't get into that thing. That's that kind of policy weighing of things was already done by the American people when they ratified the Second Amendment. That's what the policy decision is. And you don't have judges are not well suited for doing their own, you know, empirical reanalysis of whether the Second Amendment was a good idea or not. So soon after, Washington, D.C., which had banned handguns entirely and banned any gun for self-defense in the home, changed its gun laws to still try to make them as restrictive as possible, but getting rid of the handgun ban. And that led to a legal challenge before the District of Columbia Circuit Court of Federal Circuit Court of Appeals. With a three-judge panel.
Right.
One judge on that panel was then Judge Brett Kavanaugh. And he said, you know, boy, I think we're supposed to, on Second Amendment cases, do it the way the Supreme Court showed us in Heller. So we should look at history and tradition. And based on that, most of these new gun control laws in D.C. Don't have much basis in history or tradition, so they're unconstitutional. However, the two-judge majority, led by Justice Douglas Ginsburg, said, no, instead of doing history and tradition, we're going to do this step where what we call a two-part test. First of all, we will see if this issue does involve the American tradition of the right to arms. I mean, we will check on that. So, you know, if somebody said, you're banning me from possessing sarin nerve gas, and that violates my Second Amendment rights, you would say, well, no, there's really no tradition in this country of people owning nerve gas, you know, for private purposes. So you don't have a Second Amendment issue here, and the case is over. So that's fine. But then you add a second step where the court weighs the policy pros and cons and does a balancing test of the particular gun controls that are at issue. And that approach, the two-step thing where you you do a balancing test or, you know, judicial weighing of what they think are the policy pros and cons. That was adopted by most but not all of the lower federal court judges, the district and the district courts and the courts of appeals.
Sure.
And some of them took that test pretty seriously, and others, like the Second Circuit, which covers New York, or the Ninth Circuit, which covers the West Coast and the Pacific states, ended up doing that part two of the test in a very weak kind of way, and essentially saying as long as the government can come up with some evidence in favor of its position, that's good enough. And we're not even going to look. And when the other side, people challenging a law, bring in their own evidence, which undermines the government's evidence, we're not even going to look at that. All we ask is, did the government offer some evidence at all? And if they did, that's good enough, and the law is upheld. So Justice Thomas's opinion for the court says, no, the two-step test is one step too many. Either it is, the law is consistent, the gun control law is consistent with the American history and tradition of the right to keep and bear arms, as some gun control laws are. And that includes things that, it doesn't have to be an exact copy of a law from, you know, 1805. You can make analogies right from older laws to present things. Either it passes under that or it doesn't. But there's no second step where the judges get to uphold a law that is contrary to history and tradition.
Right. We are speaking with David Koppel about the Bruin case. When we come back after this break, we're going to talk about what may be coming next based on the orders that were handed down. There's a fun little debate that we can have here as to how far this may actually go. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew Mariani. We'll be right back.
Your news, the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Your news now.
Relevant Radio runs on horsepower, your horsepower. Donate any vehicle and keep your station running. Join in with thousands of other listeners who have given their unused vehicles at relevantradio.com/car.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
It's 51 minutes past the hour. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, talking with David Koppel about the Bruin decision. And the Supreme Court's Bruin decision came down on Thursday, and still a very interesting set of opinions and concurrences and dissents. We're going to get outside of that here for just a moment, find out what's going to be the next steps. And David Koppel, of course, is a research director for Independence Institute in Denver, and he's online at davekoppel.org and on Twitter at Dave Koppel. That's with a K. And Dave, this morning, the Supreme Court, of course, reached the end of its term. And so they issued their final orders, and Ketanji Brown Jackson take the oath of office. She is the newest Supreme Court justice. She's now installed on the Supreme Court. Stephen Breyer is now retired. So that was a nice way to finish up the court term. But when you take a look through the orders, there's three or four cases in there that have been vacated, remanded, you know, writs of certiorari.
Grant vacated remand,
right? There's four of them. I believe there's four of them. Now, one of them is Young versus Hawaii, which I have to tell you, I knew immediately that Bruin would basically moot this. It was going to get remanded back to the Ninth Circuit because it's the exact same situation. The only thing that was different in Young versus Hawaii was that the Ninth Circuit somehow found that Hawaiian tradition pre-statehood tradition trumped the Constitution when it came to regulating firearm carry in the state. And I was really looking forward to a Supreme Court discussion of that, you know, the opinion and the concurrences on that case. But alas, it is not to be. It's going to go back. It's going to get overturned, as amusing as that might have been. But the other three cases didn't have anything to do with carry. They had to do with two of them had to do with ammunition limits. one, you know, magazine limits on different firearms, and the third had to do with a new so-called assault weapons rifle ban, and that one's, I believe, in Maryland. You get California, right. You've got Maryland, and then I forget the third state.
New Jersey.
New Jersey, so, right, thank
there, you. You have two cases involving state laws to confiscate standard magazines. That is, a magazine that holds 11 rounds or more.
Right.
Not only did California and New Jersey forbid buying new ones, they've also ordered the confiscation of all the existing ones.
Right.
Those laws, that was upheld by the Third Circuit for New Jersey and the Ninth Circuit for California. The Supreme Court in that did what's called grant, vacate, and remand, which is all in one motion. You know, it's like, you know, for adults doing the rite of Christian initiation, where you get your baptism, your first communion, all in one day.
Right.
Confirmation too. So they grant certiorari, and then, which means they take the case, they then vacate the opinion, meaning those opinions from the Third and the Ninth Circuit are no longer valid, and then they remand, which means they send it back to the lower court, and the remand is, why don't you think about this in light of what we said in the Bruin decision? And likewise, they did the same thing for a challenge to Maryland's ban on common rifles, on various semi-automatic rifles,
right,
including ones on the AR, that's short for Armalite rifle, the AR platform, which is the most popular rifle in American history. And that had been upheld by the Fourth Circuit. And the Supreme Court, again, grant, vacate, remand. You ought to rethink this in light of how the Bruin decision tells you to analyze Second Amendment cases.
Right. So this is really about the two-step versus the one-step, right? And this is the reason why the Bruin case is probably going to be a much bigger deal than even we kind of saw on Thursday. You know, because we're talking about it in terms of carry permits and the right to bear arms, and it's definitely important for that. But this actually is going to be a sweeping decision that has to do with a lot of different gun control legislation, not just regarding carry permits.
That's exactly right. And one of the big differences between the history and tradition test, which is what Bruin says is how you do it, versus what was called the two-part test, is the two-part test allows a judge who really wants to uphold a ban to say, well, yeah, it is, owning these items is definitely part of the American tradition of the right to arms, but I'm going to uphold the ban anyway because I think it's good social policy, because the government showed some evidence in its favor about why these might be good. Never mind that the other side also showed evidence why it could be harmful. We don't look at that part of it. So, in fact, the First Circuit, after the Heller decision came out, adopted the history and tradition test and had been using that for years. And then when they got a ban on another, you know, one of these rifle bans, they switched their methodology and said, oh, no more history and tradition for us. We're going to go for the judicial balancing test. Because I think the First Circuit, which covers most of New England, accurately recognized that there's no way you can uphold these bans based on history and tradition.
Well, and again, I mean, I think that certainly the First Circuit understood that, but the Ninth Circuit and these other and Third Circuit, I think, was the other one that we were just discussing. I think it's about to become a lot more clear that this is really going to be a very much a new day in terms of what you can and cannot do in terms of Second Amendment type of limitations. And that, to me, is maybe even almost as dramatic a shift in the body politic as maybe Dobbs is going to be in terms of abortion. Got about a minute left. I'll let you respond to that.
Yeah, but I think, well, the difference is Dobbs basically just takes the Supreme Court out of the business.
yes.
and says, we're not, you know, according to the Constitution, we've got no business one way or the other, you know, either saying that abortion's banned everywhere because that's our view of human life, or to say that certain abortion restrictions are also unpermitted. That's the court's just off the playing field on this one. Here, the Second Amendment is in the Constitution, and so the court is going to have to, in the future, take more cases to address how the lower courts handle what it instructed them to do in the Bruin case. And that'll be on sensitive places. It'll be on permitting systems that might be, you know, too expensive or might take too long or might have unreasonable requirements. And it'll be about other things like laws that don't have a good fit with American history and tradition, like bans on traditional common arms.
Well, David Koppel, thank you so much for bringing us some light on this. I think it's a much more interesting decision than maybe people thought. You can go to davekoppel.org or at Dave Koppel on Twitter if you want to find out more. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew. Stand by for the Chaplet of Divine Mercy.